Welcome to our deep dive into the world of structures, how they behave, how they move, and how they react to forces.
You could say we're going to figure out how to make a skyscraper dance during an earthquake.
Okay, maybe not dance, but at least not fall down.
Right, exactly.
So our sources for this deep dive are mainly like textbook excerpts on earthquake engineering, which means we're going to get pretty technical. But don't worry, we'll try to break it down and make it fun.
We will. So are you ready to get into the dynamics of structures? It's all about how buildings and other structures react when forces act on them, especially during earthquakes.
Yeah, let's get into it. But before we start throwing around equations and stuff, let's just set the stage. What are we really talking about here? I mean, we're talking about earthquakes, which are dynamic events, right? So the forces are constantly changing. How does that impact how we think about structures?
Well, I mean, it means that we can't just think about a building's strength when it comes to earthquakes. We have to consider how it moves over time. So, like, imagine if you give a gentle push to a tall, thin structure. What happens?
It sways.
It probably sways back and forth for a bit before coming to rest.
Right.
Yeah, and that's its dynamic response, how it moves over time because of that force. And that response, well, that's a key part of understanding how a structure will handle an earthquake.
Okay, that makes sense. But buildings are made of all sorts of materials, right? Like steel and concrete.
Mm.
Do those different materials change how they react during earthquakes?
Oh, absolutely they do. Different materials, they have different properties.
Okay.
Think of like a steel component. Okay, if you stretch it a little, it'll spring back to its original shape. But if you stretch it too much,
like a paperclip, right?
Exactly, like a paperclip. Bend it a little, it springs back. But if you bend it too far,
It stays bent.
And that's the difference between what we call elastic and inelastic behavior. And that's super important in earthquake engineering because it tells us, you know, how much a structure can actually bend or sway before it's permanently damaged.
So how do engineers like actually account for all of this when they're designing buildings, especially in earthquake prone areas?
There are a lot of things they have to think about, but one of the big ones is damping.
Damping.
Yeah. Imagine you have four pendulums and you set them swinging at the same time.
Okay.
Some will come to a stop quickly while others might swing for like a really long time.
Okay.
That's because of damping. It's like a measure of how quickly vibrations die down. You can think of it like the shock absorbers in your car.
Oh, okay.
They kind of help smooth out the bumps and keep you from bouncing all over the road.
Okay. So a building with like good damping would shake less during an earthquake.
Exactly. And those damping forces, they actually come from various sources within the structure itself.
So can you calculate damping just by like looking at the structure like you do with stiffness?
You can't. That's the tricky thing. Unlike stiffness, you can't just calculate damping from the dimensions of the structure.
Really?
Yeah, you need real-world data to figure out how much damping a structure actually has.
So it's not as simple as just measuring the thickness of a beam or something like that.
Not at all. It's more like, well, you have to measure how quickly a real building stops shaking after being disturbed by something.
So like what, like a gust of wind or something?
Yeah, or even a small tremor.
Okay, so that's damping.
Mm-hmm.
So what else comes into play when engineers are designing for earthquakes?
Well, so there's this really important thing called the equation of motion.
Equation of motion.
Yeah, and it basically connects the mass of the structure, the damping, its stiffness, and the external forces that are acting on it.
Wow.
This equation is really the foundation for understanding how a structure will behave over time.
Okay, so it's pretty important.
Yeah, it's kind of a big deal.
Can you give me like a simple example of how that works?
Sure. Imagine a simple beam supported by a spring, right?
Okay.
You can calculate the stiffness of that system based on the properties of the beam and the spring.
Okay.
But even in this really simple example, gravity plays a role.
Gravity? I wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah, because the weight of the beam, that's going to affect how much the spring is compressed. And that affects the overall behavior.
So even something as constant as gravity impacts how the structure behaves dynamically.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, and that actually brings us to something called free vibration.
Free vibration? What's that?
So think about this. Have you ever noticed how, like, a skyscraper sways a bit even after a gust of wind has passed?
Yeah, actually.
Yeah, that's free vibration. It's what happens when a structure is disturbed and then left to oscillate on its own without any continuous external forces acting on it.
So it's like the building is ringing at its natural frequency.
You got it. Every structure has a natural frequency at which it wants to vibrate. And just like those pendulums we talked about, damping also plays a role in free vibration. The higher the damping, the faster those vibrations fade away.
So it's like a built-in safety feature.
Yeah, exactly. The structure naturally dissipates the energy from those vibrations.
That's pretty neat. So we've talked about what happens when a structure vibrates on its own.
Right.
But what about when something is like constantly pushing on it, you know, like during an earthquake?
Yeah. That's when we get into what we call forced vibration.
Forced vibration.
Yeah. And things can get really interesting here, especially when we start talking about resonance.
Resonance.
Yeah.
That sounds ominous.
It can be. Think about pushing someone on a swing.
Okay.
Yeah. If you time your pushes just right, you can make the swing go higher and higher, right?
Yeah.
That's resonance.
Okay.
When the frequency of that external force, in this case your pushes, matches the natural frequency of the swing.
I'm starting to see where this is going.
Yeah. So if a building's natural frequency happens to be close to the frequency of the ground shaking during an earthquake, that's when you have the potential for some serious problems.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, it can lead to like a really dangerous amplification of the building's motion, and that can obviously lead to significant damage or even collapse.
Okay, so understanding resonance is like crucial when you're designing earthquake-resistant structures.
Absolutely. And to make things even more interesting, you know, we also have to consider how damping affects the structure's response to these harmonic forces.
So more damping means like a smaller response.
Generally, yes. Huh. It's like having, you know, better shock absorbers on that swing.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it'll still move, but it won't go as crazy.
So it's like, you know, finding the right balance.
Exactly. You don't just want to add more and more damping. It's all about finding the right balance between damping, stiffness, and strength.
Got it.
To achieve that sweet spot where the structure can absorb and dissipate energy without, you know, being totally overwhelmed by it.
Mm-hmm. Sounds tricky.
It can be.
Right. So what tools do engineers actually use to find that balance? You mentioned something called a response spectrum earlier.
Yes. A response spectrum is basically a graph, and it shows how different systems with varying natural periods would respond to the same ground motion.
So like if you know the response spectrum for a specific earthquake, you can see how different types of structures would behave.
That's the idea.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. Imagine like a water tank on top of a tower, right?
Okay.
By using the response spectrum, engineers can figure out how much that tower would sway during a certain earthquake.
Oh.
So that helps them design the tower to withstand those forces and, you know, keep that water tank from, you know, coming crashing down.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But this all makes me realize that even the strongest buildings, they might just experience forces that are beyond their limits during, like, a major earthquake.
That's true.
So how do engineers even deal with that?
That's a great question. And that's where the idea of ductility comes in.
Ductility.
Yeah, ductility is basically the ability of a structure to undergo large deformations without collapsing.
Okay.
So think of like a brittle twig versus a flexible reed.
Okay.
The twig, that'll snap under pressure, but the reed can like bend and sway without breaking.
Okay.
And in the same way, a ductile building is designed to absorb energy by kind of deforming rather than resisting forces rigidly and potentially just snapping.
So it's like giving the building permission to bend but not break.
Exactly. By allowing for some controlled deformation, engineers can actually design structures that are more resilient to those extreme earthquake forces.
I wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive, but it works because inelastic deformation can actually dissipate a lot of energy.
Right.
And that reduces the forces the structure needs to resist elastically.
So sometimes a little give actually makes the structure stronger.
Yeah, you could say that, but of course you have to do it very carefully.
Right.
Engineers need to make sure those deformations are, well, they're controlled.
They don't want the building to completely collapse.
Exactly, yeah. They have to ensure that the building still remains stable.
So it's all about finding that balance again.
It always is. It's about allowing for enough deformation to dissipate energy, but also making sure the building stays upright.
Right, okay.
And that's where things can get really complex because real-world buildings, I mean, they're not simple beams or water tanks. They're much more intricate.
So how do engineers manage all of that complexity? Do they really try to analyze every little detail of a building?
Well, not exactly. That's where they use what we call simplified models.
Simplified models.
Yeah. One common type is what we call a generalized single degree of freedom system.
Okay. So they're basically creating a simplified version of the building.
Yeah.
That captures like the most important parts of its behavior.
Exactly. It's like finding the essence of the building's dance during an earthquake.
Okay, so they're basically reducing the building down to a single variable that describes how it moves overall.
That's a good way to put it.
But how do they choose that variable? That seems like a really important step.
It is a really important step, and it involves looking at the building's shape, you know, and how it's likely to deform during an earthquake.
Yep.
For example, imagine a tall tower. Engineers can approximate how that tower might bend and sway by using a mathematical function. We call it a shape function.
Okay.
This helps them define that single variable that represents the overall displacement of the tower.
It's pretty amazing how they can take something as complex as a skyscraper and turn it into a simple model.
It is, but it's important to remember that these simplified models still capture the essential physics of how the structure behaves.
Right, okay.
They're not just random guesses.
So we've been talking about structures moving as like a single unit.
Mm-hmm.
But what about buildings that are more complex, where different parts move in different ways?
That's a great question. And that's where we start talking about modal analysis.
Modal analysis. Okay, I'm intrigued. What is that?
So imagine you're watching a really complex dance routine with all these intricate steps.
Okay.
Modal analysis is kind of like breaking down that dance into a series of simpler moves.
Okay.
Each with its own rhythm and pattern. Those individual moves, those are what we call the modes of the system.
Okay.
And by understanding each mode, we can understand the overall dance.
So they're like dissecting the building's motion into these fundamental building blocks.
Exactly. And each of those building blocks, each mode, contributes to the overall response of the structure.
And this is especially important for earthquakes, right?
Absolutely. Because during an earthquake, a building doesn't just shake back and forth as a single unit. Different parts can move in different ways.
Oh, I see.
And those movements, well, they can interact with each other, creating a really complex pattern of vibrations.
So it's less like a waltz and more like, I don't know, a tango or something.
Exactly. It's more like a chaotic tango.
So modal analysis helps engineers break down that tango step by step.
Exactly. They can see how each mode contributes to the overall shaking, and they can use that information to design the building to be more resistant to, well, to specific types of earthquake motion.
It's like fine-tuning the building's response.
You could say that. It's about minimizing the unwanted noise of those vibrations.
I like that analogy.
It works, right?
Yeah, it does. So even with modal analysis, there's got to be a balance, right?
There always is a balance in engineering.
Between accuracy and, I guess, the amount of work it takes to do the analysis.
You got it.
So how do engineers decide how many of these modes to actually include?
Well, it depends on a few things, like the complexity of the building itself, the kind of earthquake forces they're expecting, and the level of accuracy they need.
Okay.
There's no one-size-fits-all answer.
Right.
But, you know, engineers have guidelines and tables to help them.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, they got to carefully consider the specific problem and choose the right amount of detail.
So it's not just a plug-and-chug situation.
Not at all. It takes judgment, experience, and a really deep understanding of how buildings behave during earthquakes.
Wow, that's a lot to consider.
It is, but it's important work. And remember, we've only just scratched the surface here. The world of structural dynamics, it's vast.
So there's a lot more to learn.
Oh, absolutely. There are so many more advanced topics and techniques that engineers use to tackle these complex challenges.
Well, I feel like we've already learned a lot. I'm already looking at buildings in a totally different way.
That's great to hear.
Yeah, I'm thinking about how they might move and sway during an earthquake.
And that's a really important takeaway. Buildings are dynamic. They're not static.
Right.
They have a life of their own.
Yeah.
Understanding that is key to designing buildings that can, you know, withstand the forces of nature and keep us safe.
Well said. We've covered a lot of theoretical ground here. But in our next part, we're going to get into some real-world examples.
Yeah, we'll see how these principles are used in actual earthquake engineering projects.
So stay tuned for that.
It's going to be fascinating. I think it's safe to say, you know, most people just assume buildings are designed to stay perfectly still during an earthquake.
Yeah, totally. Like, why would you want a building to move during an earthquake?
Right. But it's actually, like, super challenging and often just not practical to make a building that can stay completely rigid during a big earthquake.
Huh.
Instead, a lot of structures are actually designed with the idea that they will bend a little bit.
So it's more like, okay, we know this building might flex a bit during a really strong earthquake.
Right.
But let's just make sure it doesn't completely break.
Yeah, exactly. And a big part of that is understanding how the materials themselves behave when they're pushed past their limits.
Yeah.
It's not just about how strong a material is, it's also about how it responds to that stress.
So, like we were talking about steel earlier,
Right.
and how it can either spring back to its original shape or become permanently deformed,
It is
which
not.
you're talking about.
Yeah, that's a great example. So once you go beyond that elastic range, things get, well, they get a bit more complicated.
Okay.
Imagine, like, you're stretching a steel component, right? You pull it past its limit, you let go, and then you pull it again.
Okay.
The second time you pull it, it's not going to follow the same path as the first time. It's
Interesting.
kind of like the material remembers that it was stretched
Earth
before.
remembers, okay.
Yeah, in a way, the material's behavior becomes what we call path dependent,
That's the dependent. Tell me.
meaning it matters what happened to it before.
Got it.
And this is like a hallmark of inelastic behavior, and it's something engineers have to really account for when they're designing for earthquakes.
That sounds like a nightmare to deal with.
It can be complex, yeah.
How do they even design for that? Like, it seems impossible to predict exactly how a building's going to deform during an earthquake.
Well, it is complex, but one key aspect is understanding how a structure dissipates energy.
Energy dissipation.
Okay. All right, so think of it this way. When a structure deforms in that inelastic way, it's actually absorbing some of the energy from the earthquake.
Absorbing energy.
It's kind of like a boxer rolling with a punch instead of taking it head on.
Oh,
You
I
see the connection.
yeah, that makes sense. So they're not trying to prevent any deformation. They're actually using it to make the structure safer.
Yeah, exactly. If a building can bend a little without breaking, it can actually soak up more of that earthquake energy.
Huh.
And that reduces the forces that the rest of the structure has to resist.
It's kind of like letting the building roll with the punches, like you said.
Exactly. And this idea is reflected in modern earthquake engineering. The goal now is to design buildings that protect lives and, minimize damage,
Right.
even in the face of like really extreme earthquakes. It's a shift from trying to prevent any damage to, well, to managing it in a controlled way.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
All of this talk about, bending and deforming and stuff,
Right.
it makes me wonder about, like, the role of computers in all of this.
Okay.
I mean, are engineers still doing all these calculations by hand, or are computers playing a big role?
Oh, computers are absolutely essential. I mean, the equations we've been talking about can get super complex, especially when you're dealing with, large structures and those nonlinear behaviors of materials.
Right.
So, yeah, computers are doing a lot of the heavy lifting when it comes to, crunching those numbers.
But it's not like the computers are doing all the thinking, right?
Right. Definitely not.
Engineers still need to like make the decisions about
Absolutely.
how to model things
Right.
and interpret the results and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Computers are incredibly powerful tools, but they can't replace the engineer's understanding of like those fundamental principles.
So it's like a partnership.
It is a partnership between human expertise and computational power.
Cool.
And that partnership has led to some pretty incredible progress in how we design and analyze these earthquake-resistant structures. Well, for example, engineers can now use software to actually simulate how a structure would respond to a specific ground motion recording from a past earthquake.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And these simulations, they actually consider all those complex non-linearities we've been talking about.
So it's like a virtual earthquake test.
You could say that, yeah. But these simulations, they can require a lot of computing power, especially for really large and complex structures.
Yeah, I bet.
So sometimes engineers might use, they might use simplified approaches to get a quicker assess
Quicker
start.
assessment, okay.
One example is modal pushover analysis, or MPA.
Yeah, MPA.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, it builds on those modal analysis concepts we talked about earlier.
Okay.
Instead of doing a full dynamic analysis, it uses a series of static analyses to see how the structure would respond to each mode of vibration.
So it's like testing the building's strength step by step.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. They're basically pushing the building to its limits in a controlled way, but using computer models to simulate those forces.
And by putting the results of all those analyses together, they can get a good picture of how the building will actually perform during an earthquake.
Exactly. It's like a sneak peek into the building's strengths and weaknesses.
That's pretty cool.
It is. And, this kind of efficiency is super important in engineering, where time and resources are always limited.
Right.
We can't spend forever analyzing every possible detail.
Okay, so we've been talking a lot about buildings, but what about other kinds of structures like bridges or dams?
Yeah.
Do those face like similar challenges during earthquakes?
They do, and in some cases, the challenges can be even greater.
How so?
Well, like, bridges are often long and slender, which makes them more susceptible to, you know, dynamic effects like resonance.
Right.
And dams, well, they have to deal with the immense pressure of all that water they're holding back.
Okay.
And that can really change how they behave during an earthquake.
It sounds like designing for those kinds of structures is a whole other beast.
It is. It requires a different level of expertise. But the core principles that we've been talking about, things like modal analysis, damping, and ductility, those still apply.
So it's like they have the same toolbox.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they just need to use different tools for different jobs.
Exactly. It's about understanding the fundamental principles and then applying them to the specific challenges of each project.
Got it.
So a skilled structural engineer knows how to choose the right tools for the job and apply those principles to solve a wide range of problems.
All of this really makes me appreciate how much effort goes into making sure these structures can handle earthquakes.
Yeah, it's really quite impressive.
It's a pretty incredible combination of physics, engineering, and computing power.
It really is. And it's a field that's always evolving, you know, as we learn more about earthquakes and how structures behave under that extreme stress.
Speaking of learning more, one thing that really stood out to me from our sources was this focus on dealing with uncertainty.
Right.
Because earthquakes are unpredictable. So how do engineers design for something that they can't, like, fully predict?
Yeah, that's a huge challenge in earthquake engineering. We have to acknowledge that we can't know exactly when or where an earthquake will happen or how strong it will be.
Okay.
So we design for a range of possibilities.
A range of possibilities, okay.
Yeah, we use probabilistic approaches to kind of estimate the likelihood of different scenarios.
Okay.
And then we assess their potential impact on the structure.
So instead of trying to design for the perfect earthquake,
yeah,
they're accepting that there's a whole spectrum of what could happen.
Exactly. We're working with educated guesses, you could say.
So it's about, like, designing for a level of risk that's acceptable.
Exactly. And that acceptable level of risk, that's going to vary depending on the type of structure and, well, you know, how important it is.
Right. Like, a hospital would have a much lower acceptable risk than a warehouse.
Exactly. You want to be extra careful when you're designing structures that are, you know, housing people or that serve a critical role in a community.
Of course, that makes sense.
Yeah, and this risk-based approach, that's really at the heart of modern building codes and design standards.
So those codes kind of act as guidelines for engineers.
They do.
To make sure they're meeting, like, the minimum safety requirements for wherever they're building.
Yeah, exactly. It's a big collaborative effort between scientists, engineers, and policymakers.
All working together to keep people safe.
Exactly. It's about protecting lives and property from that earthquake damage.
That's awesome. So we've been talking about this in a general sense.
Right.
But our sources mentioned some specific examples of how these concepts are used in, like, actual building design.
Okay.
I'm curious about how a building's shape can affect its earthquake resistance.
Yeah, that's a great point. A building shape can really impact how it responds to shaking. Symmetrical buildings where the mass is evenly distributed, those tend to behave more predictably.
Okay.
But unsymmetrical buildings, well, they can experience some twisting forces.
Twisting.
And those can lead to uneven loading and potentially some serious damage.
It's like spinning a top.
Yeah.
If it's perfectly balanced, it spins smoothly.
Right.
But if it's off center, it wobbles all over the place.
That's a great analogy. So engineers have to be really mindful of those twisting forces when they're designing, you know, buildings with more unusual shapes.
So how do they deal with that?
Well, you know, modal analysis can be really helpful here.
But modal analysis again, okay.
Yeah, remember, we can break down a building's vibrations into those simpler modes.
Right.
And when we're dealing with unsymmetrical buildings, some of those modes will include both translational and rotational motion.
Oh, so like the twisting and turning.
Exactly. So they're looking at how the building moves up and down, side to side, but also how it twists and turns.
Okay.
And by understanding each of those modes, engineers can then design structural systems that, well, they minimize those twisting effects.
So it's like they're making sure every part of the building is working together.
Yeah.
Instead of working against each other.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about creating a system that can handle the shaking as efficiently as possible.
So what are some specific ways they do that?
Well, one common approach is to carefully place strong structural elements like shear walls or braced frames.
Okay.
And those help to, like, counteract those twisting forces.
So it's not just about like how strong the materials are, that's
Right.
also about where you put them.
Exactly. It's about how it all works together as a system.
This is all really fascinating. I'm starting to see how much thought and ingenuity goes into this whole process.
It's really quite amazing, isn't it?
It is. It's a really cool blend of science, engineering, and even a bit of creativity.
I agree. And it's a field that's constantly evolving, as we learn more about earthquakes and how structures behave under stress. But we're not quite done yet. In our next segment, we're going to explore some specific examples of how these principles are used in actual earthquake engineering projects.
So, are you ready to see some of these earthquake engineering ideas actually in action?
Absolutely. Let's dive into some real-world examples of how engineers use all these concepts, to design structures that can handle those earthquake forces.
Okay, cool. Our sources mentioned something called base isolation.
Ah, yes, base isolation.
It sounds pretty high tech. What is it?
It is. It's a really clever way to protect a building from ground shaking.
Okay.
Imagine, you're putting a building on a set of, I don't know, giant shock absorbers.
Giant shock
Yeah,
absorbers.
these shock absorbers, they're called isolators, and they basically help to separate the building from the ground.
So the building isn't rigidly connected to the ground.
Right, exactly.
So it's like kind of floating on those
Yeah,
isolators.
a great way to think about it, yeah.
So it doesn't experience the full force of the earthquake.
Well, it does, but the base isolation significantly reduces the amount of force that actually reaches the building.
That's pretty neat.
It is.
Yeah.
And it means less damage and, improved safety.
Do you have any examples of like where this has been used?
Oh, yeah, there are tons. In fact, our sources talk about this five-story building that was designed with base isolation.
Okay.
And the engineers, they compared its behavior during an earthquake to a similar building that was, directly connected to the ground.
Okay, what happened?
The results were amazing. The base isolated building, it experienced way lower accelerations, meaning it shook less violently.
So it was just riding out the earthquake more smoothly.
Yeah, you could say that. The isolators, they absorbed most of that energy from the earthquake,
Cool.
shielding the building itself from the, well, from the worst of the shaking.
That's amazing. I never would have thought about designing a building to actually move during an earthquake.
It's pretty counterintuitive, right? But it works.
Yeah, it does. This makes me realize, like, how creative engineers have to be in tackling these
Oh,
problems.
absolutely. They're always looking for these innovative solutions, to protect structures from earthquakes.
It's pretty.
And, speaking of challenges, one of the biggest ones in earthquake engineering is dealing with that uncertainty.
Right, we talked about that a bit.
Right, because earthquakes, they're just inherently unpredictable. So how do you design for something that you can't fully predict?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
It's a tough one, that's for sure. We have to accept that we can never know exactly when or where an earthquake will happen
Okay.
or how strong it will be. So we design for a range of possibilities.
Range of possibilities, that's
Yeah,
it.
and we use statistical methods to estimate, the likelihood of different events and how they might affect the structure.
So you're not designing for one specific earthquake.
Right.
You're designing for like a whole bunch of possibilities.
Exactly. We're kind of working with educated guesses, you could say.
Educated guesses.
Yeah, we use data from past earthquakes and statistical analysis to try to get a good idea of what the future might hold.
So it's all about managing risk.
It is, yeah. And that acceptable level of risk, well, that's going to vary depending on the type of structure, of course,
Right.
and how important it is. A hospital would have a much lower acceptable risk than, I don't know, a warehouse.
Right, of course.
You don't want to be taking chances with, buildings where people's safety is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. So those building codes we talked about earlier, those help to ensure that buildings are designed to an acceptable level of risk.
They do, yeah. They set minimum safety standards that engineers have to meet.
Okay, so it's really a combination of things.
It is.
Scientific understanding, engineering know-how, and careful planning.
Exactly. It's all about working together to make sure that our buildings are as safe as possible, in the face of these incredible natural forces.
Well, this has been a really eye-opening journey.
It has been fun, hasn't it?
It has. I've learned so much about how buildings behave during earthquakes and all the amazing work that engineers do to, to protect us from those powerful forces.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. And remember, earthquakes are a natural phenomenon,
Right.
but the damage they cause, that's not inevitable.
That's a good point.
With smart design and, a good understanding of these principles, we can create structures that can stand strong and protect the lives inside them.
That's a great message to end on. Thanks for taking us on this deep dive into the world of earthquake engineering.
It was my pleasure. Keep exploring and stay curious.